to do. So let's start here with me and you. Gonna take a little time. Let's see what we can find. Oh, come on,
walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Understanding is what this program is about. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and this is our first of hopefully many remote broadcasts. We are actually recording this program earlier in this year for this time in August and heading into September in the fall. And we are, first of all, wanting to thank you for tuning in to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we're going to be talking today with Swami Vidyadeshananda Giri, and he is joining us in his home. And first of all, I want to welcome you to our program and thank you for welcoming us into your home tonight.
It's my pleasure.
I remember seeing you at a talk you gave in Santa Barbara at the Victoria Hall and was moved to say this gentleman would be a wonderful voice on our program, and so here we are. And today we're going to talk about meditation. That's the gist of our conversation today. But I would like for our listeners, if you could tell us about you as a Swami. You have, if I can use this terminology, a rich lineage. Is that a way of putting it?
Yes. According to the Indian spiritual tradition, lineage is very important because that's how you keep the unbroken links of esoteric teachings and meditation teachings continue over a period of time without losing the depth of the practice. So lineage is very important, and I hail from a very important lineage, Kriya Yoga lineage, which is quite well known in the West. And also I do have other lineages of the Himalayan Masters tradition, where I'm connected to two distinct mountainous regions. Actually, each major mountain is the source of one particular lineage, one particular esoteric stream of knowledge. And I'm connected to a couple of such mountains, so I hail from those lineages too. Depending on what I'm teaching, I use my own lineage teachings of that particular meditation technique.
You are familiar, or your lineage is familiar to me through another book and other gurus down through the last 300, 400, 500, I don't know, maybe 1,000 years. I don't have the full timetable, but you are in the same, how can I phrase this, general lineage as Paramahansa Yogananda, but you have a different fellowship, which is the self-inquiry fellowship here in Santa Barbara.
Right. So actually it's the 1860s when it was revived by a very mystic yogi from the Himalayan mountain called Dronagiri Mountains, which is the root of the modern Kriya Yoga lineage. And through that, Shyamacharan Lahiri Mahasaya was initiated. He was asked to give out this meditation practice for householders. And then his disciple, Swami Sri Yukteswar, made it available for it to be taught and preserved through monks. So even though Shyamacharan Lahiri Mahasaya taught mainly to householders, he did permit a couple of his disciples to become monks. But they never created any separate lineage, and neither did they come to the West. For example, Swami Pranavananda, who was one of the most exalted disciples of Shyamacharan Lahiri Mahasaya. So Swami Sri Yukteswar's disciples came to the West, and of course, the principal and most important in the early days of, in the early years of 20th century, 1920s, when Paramahamsa Yogananda came to this country. So I am very much connected. In fact, his familial lineage, There are families who are staying in his Calcutta home. They are my co-hosts and they host me. And one family member is actually initiated by me. I'm very close to Paramahamsa Yogananda. My own master, Swami Hariharananda, whom I met in this very house many years ago, also learned it from the same lineage. So I'm connected to the Kriya Yoga lineage in that way. But then after my own master passed away, closed his earthly life, I went back to the Himalayan mountains. I went back to the root of Kriya Yoga lineage in Dronagiri mountain, and I rehashed and repracticed through authentic sources many of the techniques of Kriya Yoga. So in that way, I went back to the root through my lineage. So Kriya Yoga happens to be one of the lineages that I'm affiliated with, and I do teach Kriya Yoga to very sincere seekers of meditation who understand daily meditation practice, what it means.
So just as no limbs of a tree that branch off are separate from the tree, nor are you separate from the lineage, as people would know, of those of Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yogananda, and alike.
Correct. So in 2005, when I came down at the end of autumn, just before the winter, I came down from the Himalayan mountains and I flew back here in the United States. Many devotees thought that I might go back to the mountains and live a life of recluse, which I was really contemplating on. They requested me to create a legacy and they said that we'll make a non-profit for you to have an anchor. Please put a foot here. And so they made a non-profit called Self-Enquiry Life Fellowship, and which is a California nonprofit, California-based nonprofit, and that's how I am hosted in this country. So I try to stay about 6 months, half a year, every year in California.
Well, we are certainly grateful for your appearing on our program and having and being a part of what we are doing, and that is sharing with people the various points of view and perspectives on life as we're living it today, and how we can better our lives. And we appreciate the fact that you're going to share with us today on meditation. And we're going to do that in just a couple of moments. A reminder, you are listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and we want you to stay with us. You can hear this program live on the internet at richarddugan.com. And we ask you to stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story.
Keeping all that fear inside. I understand how trouble haunts you. It haunts me too. Yes, and I do know how you feel. Oh, come on, walk with me, talk with me.
Understanding is the very best that we can do. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we are here in the home of, the California home of Swami Vidyadishananda Giri. And we want to thank you, Swami, for joining us and again welcoming us into your home. As you share with us in this program, in this hour, about meditation, and I'm going to say from the Kriya Yoga perspective, is that correct?
I can talk about the basic foundations of meditation according to the yoga philosophy, mm-hmm. and then add a perspective from Kriya Yoga.
Okay. First, let's define what is meditation, and for many who struggle with this point, what's its purpose? What are we supposed to achieve through meditation? Because we're all fighting to achieve it, whatever it is.
Right. First of all, when we use just the word meditation, it, from a yoga philosophy point of view, implies that you are gathering your mind to become one-pointed on one object of meditation, one object of knowledge. So meditation does not mean a relaxed stage where you are not focused on anything. And meditation also by itself, when you use the word, does not mean a state where you have completely lost body consciousness. Meditation is a transition phase from a yoga philosophy point of view, where your mind is spontaneously and effortlessly one-pointed on one thought, which is repeating in a spontaneous manner, to the extent that everything else has become unimportant. There is, from a yoga philosophy point of view, there is an additional step known as samadhi, which is illumination stage, or which is a state of concentration which is one state more subtle than what we understand by calling it as a meditation. So meditation in that sense, even though a general term, it implies that mind is one-pointed, repeating one thought spontaneously over and over. Now I remind seekers that there is no worldly solution to a worldly problem. There is the mutation, there is the evolution, there is conscious evolution, howsoever you want to look at it, but whenever you want to precipitate or effect a greater solution to whatever facet of life is, whether it's simple concentration or manifesting some innate divinity or memorizing excessively, whatever the task is, it will require some form of meditation. Now the question is, if one is totally focused on jogging, can it be called as a meditation exercise? We wouldn't. From a philosophy point of view, you would need to make your body completely quiescent, completely quiet, and not be active. When the mind is not keeping or holding the body active in any physical activity, and it itself is wanting to transcend the thought processes of the world, then meditation begins. So unless we access the subtler realms within our consciousness, within our mental effort, the field of the mind, we would not call it meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you could call running and jogging as an act of concentration because you have to have mind-body integration, from a classical point of view of yoga philosophy, that would not be called as a meditation, because the mind is engaged in rhythmically making the body move. Whereas in the classical definition, you would not engage the mind to make the body active, because you are precisely trying to do the opposite. You are trying to transcend the body awareness so that subtler realms of the mind is coming into force. And why then you need to keep on honing on to one object of concentration? Because otherwise there won't be any goal you won't want to achieve. You might well relax. When your object of knowledge is defined, meditation is a long process which allows you to transcend the body awareness and the world consciousness so that you attain total knowledge of the object of concentration. And that can only be effected by taking the mind into subtler realms and recreating the object of knowledge should be recreated using that mental exercise in the subtle form. Only then can you gain total knowledge of the object. So even if your object of concentration is something which is external to you, to gain full knowledge of that object, you must recreate it in the subtle mental realm. Only then can you know the full knowledge of that object. This is the paradigm of meditation. So we would not call relaxation or any rhythmic activity as meditation, even though you might call your gentle swimming as an exercise of meditation. But classically, that will not be called meditation.
So there is no multitasking in meditation?
No.
As it were?
Absolutely. Very well taken. Their mind can only do one thing at a time very well. So even in multitasking, you are actually moving the mental focus very rapidly, one thing to another, but you cannot be simultaneously doing two activities equally well.
And there's also, it seems, as you describe it in this philosophy, it's not the quieting of the mind, it's actually the quieting of the body, so that the mind focuses, again, on that one object. Now, when you use the word object, what are you referring to in this philosophy?
Yeah. Object of concentration, object of knowledge can be anything. But let me go back to first to answer the other aspect of it, that the mind that is engaged in making the body function in a particular way is quietened along with the bodily processes. In fact, advanced meditation happens, we say nirvichara samapatti, according to yoga philosophy, when you have transcended the pulsation of the heartbeat, due to the heartbeat and the physical breath. And then the body is completely quiet and quiescent, and very advanced meditation begins. So in a way, meditation is a paradigm which has a spread. But I defined what are the basic requirements for calling something as meditation. So there is a posture, there is a steadiness, the body has to be firmly held, but at the same time, it has to be comfortable and relaxed. You cannot be struggling within yourselves with your posture and everything to meditate, because the mind will be directed toward that struggle. You need to direct the mind to something which is subtler. And when you direct the mind to something which is subtler, you automatically transcend your normal body awareness. And what is the purpose? Because only by taking the mind to higher, subtler planes and realms can we access the true knowledge behind it. So whatever we see with our sensory functions, through eyes, through skin, through hearing, and so on and so forth, is a gross level. But to gain knowledge, we have to go to the subtle level. So meditation uses a paradigm which is testable, because once you achieve that state, you gain incontrovertible knowledge of that particular object of concentration. So suppose whatever your object, most preferable object is about God. So many meditate on a form of God. There are Sanskrit literature, copious Sanskrit literature, describing different heavenly beings, how they look like, that they are subtle beings, and this is the meditation on them, on their form, including colors. So many who can identify those forms, have knowledge of them, they meditate on such forms. Some meditate on light, some meditate on sound, some meditate on subtle vibration. Yoga philosophy and other philosophies, ancient philosophies, say that the next evolute after mind is the sound. So meditation using the inner current of sound, not the external sound, but that by which we behold the external sound, the inner current of the sound, let it be just your own heartbeat as a beginning. Any synchronous rhythmic sound pattern within you and your mental field can be used as an object of concentration. It can be abstract like this, or it can be defined like a form which you are meditating upon out of your devotional collection, and you believe that that is a form of God. Or this aspect of God looks like this, and you can meditate on that. And then what happens is, once you transcend the body awareness and the physical realm, you come to know whether your meditational hypothesis is true or not, because you will know through your mental concentration whether that tenet given by the literature that this aspect of God looks like this is correct or not, because you will be able to from your meditation. So meditation is a way to ratify a knowledge base.
If I wanted to meditate on, let's say, the object being the love of God, that would be something that I would then, through the meditative process, gain the knowledge of?
The understanding of what is love for God, and how love for God is expressed, and what happens when we offer love to God, even though God is abstract, in our heart, we develop these subtle feelings, and we learn to cultivate those subtle feelings, which is based on the paradigm of love for God through our meditation process, because it is the intent. If it is pure, then surely you will get some answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also want, and we do want to get some answers, and yet it seems as though there's a phrase that I've heard many times, leave some questions unanswered for the next life, not so much in terms of the context of reincarnation, but in terms of heaven or the next realm, spiritual existence, you know, so that you have something to do, so to speak. You have something to search for. But at the same time, we want all the answers. We want to know where we came from, why we're here, and where we're going. Are those, shall we say, legitimate objects, if you will, to meditate upon? Can we get that knowledge and that awareness of the answers to those kinds of questions in a meditative state?
Those are very profound, right questions to be asked as a meditator, absolutely. I remember when I was growing up, early days, I had a sense of my own self-awareness, and I was asking the question whether my self-awareness was unique or it is same in everyone, or are they asking the similar kind of questions through their internal reflection like me? So those are absolutely the correct paradigm for a meditator, no doubt about it. So, and even if our role in the physical body is ended, has ended due to our pursuits and achievements through meditation, does not mean we lose our imprint in the subtle realm. So why not? The Sanskrit literature and the ancient philosophers are saying that everything is knowable within the human body, this incarnation, here and now. So why not ask the highest questions? Why should we leave anything to be not attempted?
And actually, those kinds of questions seem to carry more weight, and especially if we were to get the answers to them, than when am I going to win $1 million or find the love of my life or those types of things, which, again, are still legitimate questions to seek the answers to, but they are, and it kind of goes to what you said at the beginning of the program, that your worldly solutions are not going to be found in the world. They're going to be found...
There is only the spiritual solution to the worldly problems. There is no worldly solution to a worldly problem, to put it simple.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we are certainly talking about some new paradigms here on this program today. As we talk with Swami Vididhishananda Giri, and he has invited us into his home here in Santa Barbara, which I understand you are only here about half the year. You spend time in India, in a hermitage there as well, in seclusion or in whatever other spiritual pursuits and practices you do there?
Yes, I try to spend about half a year in California for some writing work, some publication work and ongoing work, and also to oversee certain needs of the organizational structure. My presence here makes a difference, but I do try to spend time in the Himalayan mountains. Sometimes I'm going up to 15,000 feet and above, sometimes only up to 10,000 feet. Depends on the terrain, depends on the time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I also spend some time in Europe whenever possible. But India is a big part because I'm involved in gathering, studying, meditating, translating very esoteric Sanskrit literature and texts from our ancient Himalayan masters tradition. And even just last year, I went to the mountain where Kriya Yoga began, where Trambak Nath, or we call him Trambak Baba, Lahiri Mahashaya called him Trambak Baba, who is known to the West as Babaji Maharaj. He initiated Samacharan Lahiri Mahashaya, that same mountain, the same temple grounds where it all began in the 1860s. I visited there and I did my practices there, and I lived in a very simple setup there. So I do periodically go, and I do have plans to keep on going mm-hmm. to the mountains, to keep connection there with my root and where I feel the environment supports my deeper and higher attempts to higher and subtler meditation techniques, it is somewhat difficult to be so visible in the world and to be traveling and to be in the West, so to say, when I'm in a teaching mode, to attempt very high and esoteric meditation practices. But in the Himalayan mountains, the surroundings and the ambience support those attempts, especially because I can live like a recluse.
Well, I know that some of us would love to have that opportunity to live like a recluse from time to time, but we all here in the West, we have been so indoctrinated or trained, or we were raised in this civilization in this way of life, that it would be hard to really, for some, not all, but for some, to walk away from it and say, no, I want to live the contemplative life. I want to live the life of, say, a monk. Take a vow of silence and never speak again, and just listen, both internally as well as externally. We can do that from time to time in our daily lives. I've only had a day of silence once in my life, and that's hard for some people to believe. And it was a rather interesting experience, to say the very least. What we want to do is experience a little bit more about meditation. So I'd like to continue that conversation in regards to, and feel free to focus on whatever specific technique you would like to, in terms of giving us some guidelines, some steps that we can take to achieve a higher state of meditation and consciousness, to have that knowledge and that awareness of the object that we choose to meditate upon.
Yes, very good. Those who are in the path of devotion, those who are devotees, those who love God through an affirmation of faith, for them, focusing in the chest, in the heart, where they start feeling something in the center of the chest, and to hold attention there is a very good way to begin. Those who are wanting to understand that thoughts never touch the silence and thoughts are superimposed on the silence and inwardly we are silent, they can hold their attention in between the two eyebrows, in the midpoint of the two eyebrows, just above which is kind of the root of the nose. And holding the attention there, one can very easily transcend thoughts. Moment you distract from that point, thoughts will come. Of course, the physical eyes have to be disengaged. In other words, the blinking, winking, and the eyelids should not move, because it is the mental focus. Now, something more tangible, yes, the inner current of the sound. If one is not able to listen to anything, then they should start by focusing on their heartbeat, the beat of the heart, and it's rhythmic. And a very beautiful sound, which is mentioned in the ancient Sanskrit literature, which is kind of the root language of many languages of the world, and that sound has been used sometimes casually, but it is a very powerful sound construct, and that's called Om. And if one is able to synchronize these heartbeat sound with the Om, as if the heart is beating and pulsating with the Om sound, it's a very powerful beginning to a meditation practice. So either we can, those who are devotees and can only focus on love for God, and they can focus in their heart straight away because they feel more than they think. Those who do not have such devotion and affirmation of faith for God, but would like to meditate and feel the results of meditation, they can focus in between the two eyebrows and listening to their heartbeat as if it is doing Om, 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 Om. So the beat becomes Om sound. Now that's the beginning. If you take it further, behind this pulsating sound, you might be able to hear a continuous sound. We say continuous current of sound or continuous stream of sound. And this pulsating sound will have, we say laya in yoga philosophy, means it will merge or, so to say, disappear. And you will be able to hold on to that continuous current of sound. And then like this, you can go subtler and deeper and subtler and deeper just on meditation on the sound. Now, as far as Kriya Yoga is concerned, it is based on a very deep thesis about our own conscious evolution, the mutation in and evolution in the universe, in the cosmos, in our earth, in our body, and how our mind mutates temporally, how we connect events temporally, and as distinct events in time, how thought processes flow, all this with the subtlest form of the physical body, which is the central nervous system. So Kriya Yoga uses breathing in a way that allows the energy content of oxygen to be absorbed in the cerebrospinal fluid. And therefore, an evolutionary mechanism along with control of thought using breath work and some aspects of the body are used in a way, in a system of meditation practice, which is a very powerful method to transcend the body awareness. We call it paravastha. It transcends, and it happens through the breathing and the absorption of the energy content in physical air. We say the oxygen is kind of taken into the cerebrospinal fluid. So cerebrospinal fluid and the blood are recharged. And there are specific points in which the mind is moving as objects of concentration in the central nervous system. And so some aspect of physiology has to be known, and it is all based on experience. So you do not have to imagine anything. You are just told the particular points of the energy circuit in your physical body, but the mind is held in a very subtle manner, concentrating on those perceived areas of the physical body in integration with the breath work, in integration with listening to the sound and internally, mentally recording that sound construct. So in the beginning, I discussed one aspect of it, meditation on the sound, for somebody who is a devotee and somebody who is just a beginner who doesn't necessarily believe in God. So an atheist and agnostic can also start meditating. There is no problem with that. But then Kriya Yoga creates a paradigm which integrates a lot of these elements into a very powerful meditation technique. And for a beginner, even an hour and a half would be very good. Some of the meditators are very much into it. They do 2 to 2.5 hours. But to do the basic sequence of techniques, it takes an hour and a half. It's a very, very powerful meditation technique. And it is an integration of the sound current with the movement of energy felt in the center of the spine and mind moving at specific concentration points from in between the two eyebrows in the forehead, as we talked about, and in the back of the body in the spine, including back of the head, which we have a very special point called shikha, which we teach, which is a very special point in the back of the head, that particular point. So there are 6 points in the back and the center in the midpoint of the two eyebrows, 7th point. And these are some called as the specific energy points where the mind has to focus. So there are various techniques, but Kriya Yoga is deemed to be one of the most advanced meditation techniques.
I understand that the process that one would go through, as you've described, an hour and a half, that's sort of a minimum. And a lot of folks, I guess I'm going to actually back up the statement I was about to make by saying that a lot of folks don't have that kind of time. But the reality is, if you want to achieve the awareness and the knowledge, you make the time.
Yes, it is. It's the priority, what you ultimately want to go for, and what is your, it, ideally Kriya Yoga is to be practiced before sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Because it takes into account the biorhythms. And once the sun is up and the nervous system functions at a different mode, and the best time to meditate is actually early hours of the morning, and even better if it is between 3 and 5 in the morning. And I know that that's very difficult for many. But in the beginning, when I talked about very simple meditation techniques using the sound current and how you focus in between the eyebrows or in the chest where you first feel, based more on the feelings, those meditations can begin with even 15, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Transcending the worldly awareness of the mind only takes about 20 minutes to half an hour. See, if one is able to repeat something one can identify with in a yearning manner, like they are really yearning to know how the mind will transcend, then half an hour is a very good start. I would say 20 minutes minimum, but half an hour would be a very good start. And one can transcend by regular practice of half an hour, and one would be able to see the results of how and to what level the mind goes to and how they feel rest of the day, because their achievements and their ability to focus and make things happen will be at a much greater efficiency. So meditation, that prioritization and putting in that bit of time to meditate in the morning would actually have a great impact on the rest of the day. So one thing to remember is that those who meditate, the effect one has to see is between two meditation sessions, how, mm-hmm. what is the impact. So because while they are in meditation in a very subtle realm, they're not going to be able to use their senses in the same way. So you are not going to look for tangible results during that time, because in fact you are going to lose the sense of time.
Yes.
What you see as a result is in between two successive meditation phases, and that's where your performance and your ability to feel your own innate divinity and how the mind is elevated, exalted, thinking only positive, these impacts will come during the phase which is rest of the day.
Well, I know that there was a time in my life when I didn't think I had the discipline. And then I started taking a look at my life and realizing, well, let's see, you have the discipline to answer to your alarm clock, to get up, to go to work, and then do all of the things that we all do throughout our day. We have the discipline to do that. So yes, we do have the discipline to meditate, if we choose to, between 3 and 5 a.m., whatever the time frame is, and for however long we're able to do that. So when we start telling ourselves we can't, well, we won't. But when we start realizing you're already doing it, that's the beginning.
Absolutely. Without a discipline, without a mental affirmation to go for it, one would not even begin it. In the beginning, it is the difficult. Once it becomes like food for the soul, then you won't be able to live without it, because just like you eat and shower and take them for granted, you will want to make meditation as part of your daily routine, and then only the subtler and higher questions of life will come to light, and we would seek something deeper. And when we seek something very subtle and deeper, then the worldly problems and the worldly difficulties look different to us. They don't trap us the same way.
I notice you did not say, when you made the comment at the beginning of the program, that your worldly concerns and difficulties are not solved through worldly solutions. You also have not stated that through meditation, your worldly problems and conditions will go away. It's that your perspective will change.
Yes, and you get deeper mental strength to handle them. You would look at it differently. So one who has higher states of realization, they do not ponder over the same questions, and many things will become petty and will fall away. And so obstacles take up a new definition, and you learn to live life with in a different perspective. And to expect that meditation will remove all challenges of life would be a very wrong hypothesis to begin meditation with.
You mentioned earlier in the program, and this was off on a little different of a tangent as we took a short little pause there and let people know that they were listening to this program and listening to you and I talk about meditation. You talked about translating Sanskrit, and I understand that you have a major, I think it's a major project or endeavor that's ongoing to teach Sanskrit. Is that correct?
I do not teach the Sanskrit language just because, you know, there are many teachers of them and I don't have the time. Mm-hmm. But I do study, meditate, and translate very esoteric scriptures. We call it scriptures for lack of a better definition. These are ancient Sanskrit literature and texts which are available in India, which have been preserved through our lineages, and they have an application part which is only preserved by the lineages. So it's one thing to read them, but it's another thing to know what is behind mm-hmm. it and how to make it applicable and how to use it in your study and meditation and even practical applications. So I take and study those verses from my senior monks. I've done it for years, and in the Himalayan mountains I've studied very advanced Sanskrit scriptures and grammar and linguistics and meditational texts and so on and so forth. And I have spent quite a bit of time in translating them into modern languages, because unless we make them available in modern languages, it will remain very esoteric to rest of the world. So since I'm spending time in the West, and especially in US, the organization spends quite a bit of its effort in making sure that those texts which have been preserved by these unbroken lineages, the essence of those teachings are also made available to sincere seekers in the modern world.
But there's also something about Sanskrit that is valuable to the student who is learning to read it and or write it, that helps them in other parts of their lives and even in other parts of their studies. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. There are quite a bit of study available on that. In fact, there is one school in London who has kind of made Sanskrit compulsory because the students do much better. I've been speaking about accelerated learning from the Sanskrit tradition, talking about the Shruti method by which one can enhance the memory. I gave a talk many years ago about sonic resonance of the nervous system in a university. And because Sanskrit uses sound constructs which are very pure, and it's a root language, and it has no sound shift over the years, and it is structured in a unique manner. In fact, the word Sanskrit means that which is perfected. So there seems to be a very direct correlation between the level of function of the nervous system, how the nervous system responds to the recitation, sublime recitation, if you would want to call it, or chanting, you would want to call it, of Sanskrit. And another way is that our cognition is connected with hearing and speech more than the visual part. So it actually goes in a sequence: hearing, touch, visual, and then taste and smell. So hearing, speech, and cognition being connected, so when we chant Sanskrit by hearing, it somehow helps with the enhancement of the memory. And of course, there are additional parts to it, like we have to listen with our eye contact so that we can absorb it and so on and so forth. But hearing and speech being connected with cognition makes us use the Sanskrit sound constructs in a very unique manner. So Sanskrit, being a perfect language as it is, has been recognized as a very valuable tool of research for artificial intelligence. It's the base of all linguistics, and it also enhances by its use, oral use. spoken use, somehow the memory and the brain capacity to be accessed to the fuller extent. So these are the great advantages of not losing our connectivity with the root language, which is should be deemed as a universal heritage.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I've only done a little study in Sanskrit and slightly less in the Hebrew language, the alphabet and all of its elements and the keys to it. And it's extraordinary what happens when you translate from the root language to others. So much is lost. So we need to go back and take a look at that. We're going to take a short break. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we are talking with Swami Vidyadishananda, and we are talking with him in his home, and we're going to continue our program here in just a moment. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
All the trouble that you know empties out as you go.
This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I am joined by Swami Vidyadishananda, and we are in his home this evening as we record this program on what is deemed and called Holy Saturday. It's during the Easter celebration in the Christian traditions, and we are talking about meditation. And it's, to me, it's extraordinary to be sitting here with you and doing this recording and the ability to be able to send this kind of information, not just here in the room with the people who have joined us, Amrita, my wife, as well as others, but also throughout Santa Barbara and literally around the world. It's phenomenal. And I know that part of your lineage has to do with spreading these kinds of teachings, not just to the West, but it seems as though the West is where you have been led to be, and so you're teaching us. And I want to thank you for that.
Yes, I welcome those comments and the sensitivity to the tradition, the ancient tradition of the monks, and the great foundation was laid down by the great masters of this lineage in the West, and I'm very happy to be representing them to put forward the teachings, authentic teachings of the lineages I hail from. Thank you.
And again, the nonprofit organization is Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship, correct?
Correct.
And people can search that on the internet. There is a link at richarddugan.com to your website, and people can go there and get more information. And once again, I want to first of all thank you for sharing your time with us, but also your home with us for this broadcast.
Yes, I thank you, and I welcome you to be here. Thank you very much.
And we look forward to having you back to talk more. My understanding is the month that we are broadcasting this program is also the month birth of Babaji. And there are those who know who that is. And for those who don't, we hopefully will come back in August and record another program talking about more in regards to the philosophies that you are bringing here to the West.
Yes, all welcome.
I'm Richard Dugan, and I thank you very much for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we ask you to join us every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Evan, that is Saturdays. You can also hear this program live on the internet, streaming live at richarddugan.com. And you can hear these archives at richarddugan.com. So be sure to check out the radio show's page, as well as the link to the Swami's website and the Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship. I'm Richard Dugan, and I thank you so much for joining us. Join us again next Saturday at the same time for Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Love to love.
Oh, there's a thousand things to do. So let's start here with me and you. Gonna take a little time.